offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage, a series in which together we try to contemplate on and understand the beautiful verses of the Bhagavad Gita, the song Divine, which was delivered by Lord Shri Krishna to his dear friend and disciple Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. And we've taken up this series where we go through every shloka in that work. We try to go through the meaning and the inner meaning as explained by Swami on many occasions, and based on what Swami has taught us on various occasions, not necessarily mentioning the Bhagavad Gita or the verses that we go through. And of course, we will rely a lot upon Swami's words specifically, especially when Swami has written the Gita Vahini, a book on the Bhagavad Gita, and of course the many discourses that Swami has delivered precisely on the shlokas. But much of what we've covered so far is only the first chapter, and the first chapter is traditionally left out in most commentaries. In fact, one of the most famous commentaries or bhashyams written is the one written by Adi Shankara, and it begins only from the 10th verse of the second chapter. And of course, we'll see why that is so as we come to the second chapter. But as of now, we are in the first chapter, and most probably we'll complete it today. Hopefully, we'll have enough time to do that. Before we begin, let me give you a short summary of what we went through last week, because what we're going to begin with this week is I think a part of that we started off last week, and I gave a explanation for that too. So I think it would be right for me to begin with a short summary. Last week we had gone through verses 35 to 40 of the first chapter, which is referred to as Arjuna Vishada Yoga. Arjuna says that even if the reward for killing all of these people who assembled in front of me is the dominion or the overlordship over three worlds, he says that he doesn't want to do that. And when that is the case, why would I, Krishna, take up arms and fight against all of these people for merely a worldly kingdom? That's what he asks. And as we've been going through past couple of weeks, these are all monologues of Arjuna, where Arjuna is literally lamenting what is going on in his mind, and that is why it is referred to as Arjuna Vishada Yoga, which means the despondency of Arjuna. Vishada means despondency or depression. So that is what this is all about, and Krishna has not interrupted him at all. He's been going on and on, and as we've seen, he has come to the point where he has concluded his main argument or the main reason why he does not wish to take up arms and fight in this battle, which is that these are all my people and I don't want to fight against them. And he mentions that I don't see any pleasure in killing them. As we said, he says that when I don't wish to kill them, there is a question of wanting the kingdom after that and the pleasures that come from the kingdom. So he says that I do not see any pleasure in killing these people who belong to me, even though they are aggressors. That's what he says. Atitaina is the word which he uses in Sanskrit. He says, I know these are aggressors which are meant to be punished, but I don't find any pleasure in doing that. And he quickly says that there is no pleasure to be got now, and there is no pleasure to be got hereafter too, which means punya or merit, which one gains because of doing good acts. He says, even in the future, I don't find this leading to any punya, because he's going to explain why he does not see this as a meritorious act. But then he says the fact that this war is bad is known to both sides, because we've been brought up in the same value system. But the Kauravas are blinded by greed. But when we are not blinded by greed, shouldn't we be more responsible, and shouldn't we say that we don't want to participate in the war? That is the argument Arjuna places in front of Krishna. And then he says, Arjuna starts building his case with ancillary arguments. As we went through last week, I was explaining how most of us do that. We have a primary reason or a primary cause for a decision that we make, but we tend to try and build our argument by taking other causes and reasons to build our case, which we might not have thought of when we made the decision. But we try to make our decision seem more palpable and more secular by bringing in all these other factors. And that's what Arjuna begins to do in that final few verses that we went through last week, the 39th and the 40th verse, where he recognizes that here is Krishna in front of him, and if he has to make his decision appear more appealing to Krishna, then he'll have to factor in aspects which are dear to Krishna. Well, I'm not too sure whether this was what Arjuna was thinking, but these are all, it at least appears so, because these are arguments which, as we are going to go through, one might wonder, did Arjuna really think of all this when he started feeling despondent? But then he starts building his case, and what is dear to Krishna is the establishment of dharma. That is what we've always known. So he says that what I'm going to do is going to destabilize dharma, because he feels that that will be something which Krishna will be interested in, an argument which would probably strike a chord with Krishna. So he begins that, and he starts off that argument last week, as he says, the last verse that we went through last week was, when so many members of a family are destroyed, the traditions of that family get destroyed with that, people who perish in a battle. And when that happens, the vices take over the family. And how does that really happen? How does adharma result when traditions of the family, or you know, the belief systems and traditions, how are they related to dharma? In fact, that is what we will be going through in this week's session, because that is what Arjuna explains in the verses that we're going to go through today, which is 41 to probably 47, which is the last verse in this chapter. So we'll begin with verse number 41, and very interesting arguments. Very, very important. I mean, these are not arguments meant to be belittled. These are very important arguments in the sense that we understand the working of dharma in a society through these arguments. But nevertheless, these arguments are not fair arguments which are given by Arjuna. We'll see that also. But for now, let us not be too biased against Arjuna. He's, after all, a poor man who's in immense confusion. And place yourself in the place of Arjuna, where he's standing there, he's supposed to perform this immense task. I think it is quite natural for somebody to feel so nervous, because you are not too sure of what is going to be the outcome of your action. And every action has innumerable outcomes, and we are not fond of all the outcomes, right? And so Arjuna is here. At this point, he's able to see only those outcomes which are not favorable. And that is why he's so depressed and he's so dejected. So with a little bit of empathy for Arjuna, let us go through these verses. Now I'll play for you verse number 41. As we all know, it's been beautifully rendered with very, very beautiful clarity by Brother Shyam, one of our old students. And we'll listen to verse number 41, and I'll give you the meaning and we'll discuss about that.
अधर्माभिभवात् कृष्ण प्रदुष्यन्ति कुलस्त्रियः स्त्रीषु दुष्टासु वार्ष्णेय जायते वर्णसंकरः.
By the prevalence of impiety, O Krishna, the women of the family become corrupt. And women being corrupted, O Krishna, there arises intermingling of varnas or castes. So Arjuna goes on to explain the whole sequence of events. In this shloka, he mentions how women are actually the final frontier when it comes to protection of dharma. All the warriors have come here to participate in what we can refer to as a dharma yuddha, or a battle which is meant to establish dharma. And it is meant to uphold dharma in the society. And till now, Arjuna was saying that, you know, these are the people who will have to further dharma, and they have to do it by practicing it. And if we are going to be killing these people who are supposed to be the upholders of dharma, there's going to be a fall in dharma or a depletion of dharma in society. But here in this shloka, Arjuna is very clearly explaining how it actually happens. When the overall dharma begins to fall, because here is, as we have seen, a huge conglomeration of rulers, and the rulers are supposed to be the caretakers of dharma. So in one battle, never has been such a gathering of great rulers. So he says that him participating in the war, and there's going to be immense destruction, and this is going to lead to, eventually, you know, there's going to be a wholesale destruction in dharma, if you could put it that way, right? So when there's an overall fall in dharma, eventually adharma starts infecting the women too. That's why he says here, adharma abhibhavat. Sorry, adharma abhibhavat. Because of adharma going out of control, pradushyanti kulastriyaha. The women of the kula or the clan are also infected. So even if the man of the house or the men of a certain place become adharmic, a new generation of dharmic or righteous individuals can be raised. And how is that possible? Because the women, if they remain pious, they will be able to raise children who are righteous, isn't it? But if there is an en masse destabilization of dharma, even the women will eventually get affected. And that is what Arjuna is saying here. So even in a battle, if you look at it that way, the foot soldiers are the ones who will be right in front of a battalion in the formation, right? But that doesn't mean that they are the most important who are going to bring you that victory, or who are going to be the cause for you being able to defeat the opponents. And you'll always have these mighty warriors who probably form the second row, the third row of the battalion formation, right? That's how generally it is. So in a similar way, the real heroes are the ones who actually probably are nearest to the most important. In fact, one of the verses where Duryodhana says that here is Bhishma and he's the most important member of our army and he has to be protected. So he tells all the great warriors to keep an eye on Bhishma and protect him, right? So similarly, the foot soldiers are the ones who are right in front, but they are not necessarily the ones who are going to bring you victory in the battle. So in the same way, though the men have assembled to fight for dharma, the real protectors are always only the women. What the soldiers and warriors do is to create a secure society where dharma can be practiced fearlessly. Swami would in fact say this about Duryodhana and his brothers. It was very unfortunate that they were brought up by their mother Gandhari, who had taken this vow that she would keep herself blindfold as a form of being faithful to her husband, right? And Swami would say that yes, she was very faithful to her husband, but she was not being a good mother, because here were the Kauravas, and Swami would say that Krishna tells Gandhari at one point where your children have not had the good fortune of having been looked upon by their own mother with love and concern, then how do you expect the Lord to have the vision of grace on them, right? So it's very, very important. There's a very important observation that Arjuna is making here, that the women are really the final caretakers or protectors of dharma. And when an en masse fall of dharma happens, and this is what will happen, the women too will start falling in their dharma. So he says that with these men dying, the overall dharma will fall. That's why he says, Kritsnam adharmaha abhibhavati. A wholesale fall of dharma will happen. And under such conditions, even the women slowly get corrupted. And when that happens, he says, Strishu dushtasu. When women get corrupted, jayate varna shankaraha, it results in the confusion or intermingling of varnas or castes. Well, I think in the modern context, this might be a little unacceptable to us, where we say that the intermingling of castes is a cause for concern or is a cause for the righteousness in the society falling. But in the past, I think in the earlier yugas, this was one of the very important mechanisms, but which was used in society to ensure that there is a little bit of order in society. You know, there were clear demarcations of who will do what profession and how a certain profession has to be done. And if somebody is in that particular caste or varna, how that person should lead one's life. And marriages would be strictly performed between within those varnas or castes. And this was one of the mechanisms by which order was maintained in society. And if I could probably make it a little more clear, let's say that you have a huge highway or a broadway or an expressway or whatever you call that. One of the ways you ensure that there is less chaos on this road is you have multiple lanes, right? I mean, we've all been through expressways and highways. We've seen that there are multiple lanes, and the different lanes are meant for different things. Sometimes the lanes are based on the speed limits. You'd have some of these heavy trucks which will probably stick to a lane which is in the left. The faster cars are usually in the lanes which are closer to the middle of the road. So why is this kind of regulation which is made? It is only so that there is order on this road, right? This is not any form of discrimination against a person who is driving a certain vehicle, right? It can never be spoken of in that manner. So this is only a manner of ensuring that there is less chaos on the road. The road certainly equally belongs to all, but following this discipline helps everyone on the road have a peaceful journey, right? And speaking of equality in such a situation is quite meaningless. And I mean, you can't say that the road belongs to everybody and everybody can drive on all roads. And that's precisely what happens on Indian roads. And we know what chaos that causes, right? Similarly, I think in the past, they were using this strict Varna system of who will do what task. And if you're doing that task, how you lead your life. And you ensure that, you know, children born in that particular caste or that particular family will continue that tradition and they would marry within that same caste in Varnas. Of course, in the modern world, this particular system is absolutely gone out of context. I'm not suggesting that we should follow this strictly. It is not meant to be that way at all. It is completely gone because of two reasons. One is there is already so much chaos, right? If I'm going to be driving on a road and there is no lane discipline which is being followed and everybody is going here and there, well, I can say that I will follow the lane discipline, but I cannot ensure that everybody else does. I can follow it myself, but I cannot enforce it on others. Right? That is one of the problems that we will have. So there is already confusion in this society and it is not possible to force this system into place, and that's what happens in many of the places in India, and that leads to disaster. And the other reason why it will not work in the modern context is, I think in the past, the belief in the karma system or the fact that every individual is a soul which is traveling from many, many bodies, and based on one person's actions, a particular birth has been gifted or has been taken up by that soul. That belief system was so very strong. Right? When that belief system is strong, I think it's easier to understand that each one being born in a particular caste is not necessarily just a result of chance or, you know, I mean, one person is not responsible at all. Because that's the argument we always give. Why should somebody who is born in this caste be penalized? It's after all a child which is born in this family. But when that belief system is very, very strong, that karma decides, one person's action decides which birth he or she is gifted with after one passes away. It becomes very easier to look at the system as a disciplining system, right? So I'm not suggesting that we should be following this even in the modern context. But what we are talking of is the setup in the Dwapara Yuga, right? Arjuna is referring to the Dwapara Yuga where this was a system which was in vogue and this was a means by which there was order in society so that everybody could progress. So it is not quite surprising that Arjuna is making this statement, and that's why he says, when these great men who follow dharma perish, the second line of defense, which is the women, they will get corrupted, and when they get corrupted or when they become adharmic, there will be total confusion that is caused by intermingling of dharmas or intermingling of castes, and each caste follows a certain dharmas which are different. We'll come to that in a little while because Arjuna is not done yet. He's going to explain this even further. So we'll listen to verse 42 of chapter 1. I'll give you the meaning and we'll discuss that.
Sankaro narakayaiva kulaghnanam kulasyacha पतन्ति पितरो ह्येषाम् लुप्तपिण्डोदकक्रियाः.
And the intermingling in the family leads the ruiners of the family verily into hell. The forefathers of these fall down because of being deprived of offerings of rice balls and water. So now he is talking of what happens when there is a fall in dharma in the society, and then there is intermingling of castes, as we have, as we just mentioned in the previous shloka. So he says that this confusion ruins the whole society. So those who cause this confusion will go to hell, and those that are a product of this confusion will also go to hell. That is his argument, because they will not be following the dharma they are meant to follow. And not only that, when people forget their duties to one another, and that is what we mean by saying that adharma will prevail, how are they possibly going to remember the duties that they are supposed to do towards their ancestors or pitrus? And so that also will stop. So he says, so they will not perform the pinda udaka kriyaha. The pinda udaka kriyas are the traditional offerings that are made of pinda. It's actually a rice ball and water. It's a traditional offering which is made. And it's a ritual which is performed so that those ancestors who have passed on are peaceful wherever they are. In fact, I think we've had a couple of questions on this, and I mentioned there, when Swami had been to Badri during his visit in the 1960s, at one particular place, I'm not getting the right name right now, I think it's Brahma Kapal, that particular place is meant for these ceremonies which are performed of offering pindas, and Swami ensured that everybody who had come with Swami sat there and did that ceremony, and Swami himself actually went down to the Alaknanda, filled water in a copper vessel. And, you know, we were talking about pinda udaka kriya. Udaka means water. So Swami himself brought that water. Swami materialized a ball of vibhuti and put it into that water and ensured that all these people who had come with Swami perform it. Because it's a important tradition in Sanatana Dharma. So Arjuna is saying here, the pinda udaka kriyas will not be done. And because of this ritual not being performed, even the ancestors or pitrus will fall from grace. So this is his argument. He's saying, you know, that first of all, there's going to be confusion in society, and those who cause that confusion are going to go to hell. Those who are a product of that confusion are going to go to hell. And those children who are born out of this confusion will not be performing these kriyas which are meant for ancestors, and because of which even the pitrus in the pitruloka are going to fall. Probably I'll spend a couple of minutes about these traditions, and I think I'd mentioned this even when we had done those answers on these traditions during the answering booth. You know, when one of the things that we came by in the course of that explanation is, much of these is based on one's own belief systems. Swami would not force these traditions on anybody. But if there is a leaning towards these traditions, or these traditions are part of your family, Swami would not stop anybody from doing it, and Swami might even encourage a person from doing it, just like what I said about that Badri visit. But there is a very sound logic behind why this was done, and it was a part of a larger system which was put in place so that a person leads a dharmic life. Right? Because the moment I think that, you know, my children will do these pindodaka kriyas, and, you know, because of that I will be peaceful in my afterlife, the way I look at family life and approach a grihastha life itself will be completely different. And if my children really have to perform these kriyas for me, then they should themselves be brought up in a righteous and responsible manner. So that will ensure that I bring them up in the right manner. So all these belief systems are meant to, in as many ways as possible, regulate our life and ensure that we lead lives in the right manner. So again, we are talking, all of this, don't forget, is happening in the Dwapara Yuga. So all of these practices were followed big time there. And these are all very important. In fact, in the Dwapara Yuga, I mean, now we say that we do it once a year, right? There it is actually done every month. Every month, one particular day, these kriyas have to be performed. So it's one of the most important rituals that a householder performs. So he says that all of these traditions are going to be broken, and when these traditions are broken, you will find that even those pitrus were dependent on their children to perform these ceremonies for them, they will also be affected. So Arjuna says the one who caused such wholesale confusion in society will go to hell, which means he's referring to himself, because he's saying that if I participate in the war, I will be the person who is causing this confusion. And he says those who are a product of this confusion, the children who are born out of these confused families, they will also go to hell. Shankaro narakaya eva kulagnanam kulasyacha. Those who are born in these kulas and those who cause this confusion in the kulas, both will go to hell. So he says that, and then eventually even the ancestors are going to suffer. And when you look at this argument, I think that's the question which comes to you. Did really Arjuna think of all of these possibilities when he said, I don't want to fight? When we are in confusion, do we really think of all these things before we say that I don't want to do this or I want to do this? And if we want to perform a task, if we want to, you know, take a certain decision, be it in our family life, be it when we want to marry a person, or when you want to start a business, or when you want to, take up a course in your studies. Do we think of all of these possibilities when we make a decision? Invariably, it is a very impulsive decision. It's a very passionate decision, just like how it is for Arjuna. It was a decision driven by passion, right? It was a decision driven by a certain emotion. But logic always follows. And as I explained last week, it is not wrong always, because the mind looks for logic. Sometimes we are driven by our conscience, but we need a certain amount of logic so that the mind is also silenced and brought along. But when the decision itself is wrong, when the impulse for a decision is driven by one of the lesser qualities, here in the case, it is being driven by attachment, right? Because that is what Arjuna keeps repeating, Swajanaha, Swajanaha. He says, my people. So when it is driven by attachment or mamakaram, the ancillary reasons which follow are very, very dangerous. So these are all the ancillary reasons that Arjuna is giving. He's saying that, you know, the women are going to get spoiled, there's going to be intermingling of castes, then there's going to be fall of the children, and there's going to be fall of the ancestors. It seems pretty unbelievable that Arjuna would have thought of all of these things when he said to Krishna that I don't want to fight in the battle. Nevertheless, this is a beautiful peek into how the human mind works, and that is why it is important not to look at Arjuna and say, oh Arjuna, you're such a fool, you know, you're doing all of these false arguments. No, it is not like that. This is exactly what happens in each one of our minds. The next time something like this happens, you remember that this is the sequence of events. I'm saying this because I noticed this so many times in my own mind, and I know it happens with everybody, isn't it? So this is the argument which Arjuna is giving, and he's still not done with it. We'll go to verse number 43 and we'll see what he has to say there.
Doshairetaih kulagnanam varnasankarakarakaih utsadyante jati dharma kuladharmascha shashvata.
By these evil deeds of the destroyers of the family, which cause confusion of castes, the eternal religious rights of the caste and the family are destroyed. So Arjuna concludes, though the evil deeds of killing one's, through the evil deeds of killing one's family, confusion of castes and mixing up of races will happen, as we saw last verse. And that will result in breaking of tradition that has been followed for many, many generations. Right? Utsadyante will be destroyed completely. Jati dharmaha, the practices relating to a particular caste. Kula dharmaha, traditions of a particular clan or family. Shashvataha, those which were followed for many, many generations without a break. He mentioned one of the traditions in the previous verse, which was the Pinda Udaka Kriyas, which are performed for ancestors. But he's saying that all the other traditions also will be broken if the families are disrupted in this manner. I think it would be useful for us to spend a few minutes in trying to understand this whole thing. Why is Arjuna giving this entire logic? And also we will understand why this logic is actually wrong in this particular context. But the logic itself is not wrong. What Arjuna is saying is very, very beautiful and very important to keep in mind when we make a lot of decisions. But in this particular context, I think what Arjuna is saying is wrong, and we'll see that. When we use the word dharma, when we say dharma, it is one of the most deep words in Sanskrit, and Swami himself has said this in many of his discourses, that no one word in English or any other language adequately defines this word, because it's such a deep word, so rich in meaning and in import. But I'm not going to try to talk completely about it and explain completely, because the entire Gita, we're going to come across this word many, many times as we go into it, and Bhagavad Gita is probably one of the texts which gives the most beautiful explanation of dharma, though there are so many other dharma shastras, like I think Vidura Niti is there, and there are many, many. Manusmriti is one of the dharma shastras. Even though there are many, many dharma shastras, one of the best book which speaks about dharma is the Bhagavad Gita. So we're not going to go completely into that. Today is not the day for that. But we'll start. I would like to give you a very simplistic explanation of dharma, just to explain this logic which Arjuna is presenting here, because I feel it's quite important, and I hope I'm not wrong. What is dharma essentially? Let's look at it in a very simplistic manner. If I was to give you a very, very simple explanation, we all are on a journey, right? We all have a journey, and a journey always has a destination. So each one of us are at different points in this journey, which is leading to the same destination, right? That is the understanding of spirituality. The destination is the same, but we are all coming from different sides, and we are all on different points in this journey leading towards this particular destination. And each part of the journey is quite different. Some part of it is probably a smooth highway. Some parts of it, the journey probably goes through pothole-filled roads. Some may be going through very steep highs and steep lows. Some part of it probably is going through very thick and dark jungles. And some may be going through very crowded, narrow lanes. So as I said, dharma is that optimal action that I need to be doing at any point in this journey that ensures that I am progressing towards my destination. Let's say that that is the definition of dharma that we are giving. So when the pathway can have stages which are so different in nature, one is a smooth road and one is a narrow road, as I just mentioned, how I must drive at each point in this journey will definitely differ, isn't it? Even though my goal is to ensure that I'm progressing towards the destination. I can't go at 100 kilometers per hour on a pothole filled road, though going at that speed is the right thing to do when I'm on a highway, right? So the basic dharma is that I should be moving towards the destination. That is the individual basic dharma. But what exactly I must do at various points in this journey depends on some external parameters, what we refer to as desha kala paristhiti, place, time and circumstance. So now I am not alone on this journey. That's the other factor. There are many, many others who are traveling on the same road, or probably at different stages, and it's a crowded lane that we are in, just like the example that I started off with. When you have a huge highway, one of the ways by which you bring order in that highway is by having a lane system. You have different lanes for different vehicles. So apart from me progressing on this particular highway, I should also ensure that I'm at least not a hurdle to the others who are on the highway. And if I can, I should be able to help others also progress towards the destination. And if I can't do that, I should at least ensure that I don't impede them in any way. And in a sense, that also becomes part of my duty in that particular leg of the journey. So in this group dharma, in this dharma which is apart from desha kala paristhiti, it also depends on the people who are around me, this is what we refer to as probably varna dharma, or the dharma which is based on which lane you are in. And as I explained, the lane discipline that we follow is you know, depends on which particular vehicle that you're driving in also, right? So that is probably the berth that you've taken in that particular leg of the journey. And for a set of individuals to come together and follow something collectively, there should always be a kind of bonding together, right? Otherwise, there'll never be, I mean, why are we collectively following a particular, let's say, a political system, right? We have a democracy in this country, or some other country, they have monarchy, or some other country, they have a two-party system, or some other country, they probably have coalition governments like in our country. We as a unit have come together and have decided that we will all follow this particular system. And how will we come together and decide to follow this particular system? Only if there's some kind of bonding between each other, right? So there should be some sense of belonging. And this sense of belonging is brought about through traditions and rituals. This is one of the ways by which that binding happens. In fact, I don't know when, in the context of which question I spoke about this, where this is how societies were formed, right? For many, many species through which the human species has evolved, the ideal number for forming a society was always about 100 and 150. That was a peak number. The largest colony will not be more than about 150 individuals. How did we breach that number? And in fact, breaching that number to form a larger society was one of the most important things that happened in the progress of this human species itself. And that happened by sharing common ideas, sharing common ideologies, right? So that is how today we are a nation of 1.2 billion people. That's where is 150 individuals and where are 1.2 billion people. How has that been possible? And it has been possible because we have a common ideology. We have a sense of belonging. We feel that we are all one countryman, right? And that happens by, in a family, it happens by following common traditions and rituals, right? So these traditions and rituals are what is referred to as kula dharmas. And when there are traditions, there will be this binding which happens. And when there is binding and when there is bonding, there will be dependence. The individuals in that particular group will depend on each other. And when there is depending on each other, one is likely to follow a rule which is placed, right? When I know that if I don't follow this particular rule, tomorrow when I need you, you will not come and help me. Or this is the rule in the society, and if I don't follow this rule, tomorrow when I need the backing of the society will not come to my help. That will discipline my thinking spontaneously, isn't it? I will know that this is how I should believe. And I think, again, this is again, we've spoken about this on many, many occasions in the Answering Booth program, how a society can regulate lives of individual without depending on the legal system, where the society places a soft pressure on the individuals because there is this understanding which is unspoken, unwritten within a group of individuals, which makes a person toe the line, so to say. Right. So that is how an individual dharma, which is the most important thing. The most important thing in life is that individual dharma, which we refer to as Atma Dharma. Right. That's what we'll probably come to that in the course of Bhagavad Gita. The Atma Dharma is the most important, that I should do everything that takes me one step closer to my destination, the destination of this soul. But to be able to follow that, to enable me to follow that, the society puts all of these rules and regulations which are meant, what is based on my birth, it is referred to as Varna Dharma or Kula Dharma. What is based on my age is referred to as Ashrama Dharma, whether I'm a student, whether I'm a householder, whether I'm a person who is retired or I'm a person who can retire completely away from society. Based on that, there are some practices which I have to follow. So each one of these are meant to enable me to follow my Atma Dharma. And this bonding happens when there are traditions and there are rituals which bind this group together. There is a sense of belonging which is created. In fact, we do this all the time. We don't realize it. We do this all the time. You know, even if you look at how Swami goes about doing it, why does Swami insist that we all should wear whites? Of course, Swami also says that It it leads to a sense of purity. In fact, very jocularly, Swami would say that white stands for purity, and you don't have inner purity, at least you will have external purity. That's what Swami had told in one of the discourses. But apart from that, there is a sense of belonging when there is uniformity of some form, right? So when we all come here, we follow common traditions. You know, bhajans are meant to be a very emotional way to connect to God. But why are there disciplines even in bhajan singing? Why did Swami insist that this is how bhajans have to be sung? Because all of these rituals and traditions give us a sense of belonging. And when there is a sense of belonging, there is binding between individuals. And that will lead to we leading a disciplined life. And once the externals enable us to lead a disciplined life, we will individually also be leading a disciplined life, right? So this is the entire sequence of how it happens. But as I said, you know, we'll keep coming back to this topic, because Krishna explains this in much, much detail and the way we need to understand this. But the other point is, this entire argument which Arjuna is placing before Krishna also shows how Arjuna was not a novice. He knew right and wrong, and he knew the workings of dharma, and he knew the workings of a society which is trying to regulate dharma in the life of individuals, right? So in just a matter of couple of verses, he has explained the entire system of dharma and how a society works. So it shows that Arjuna is not a novice. But this is still superficial knowledge, and there is a fundamental flaw in this, as I said, because see, going back to the explanation that I gave of how we are all traveling on a journey, and to regulate traffic, we have different lanes. Let us say there is one person who is a rogue driver, who is driving on the wrong lane, or who's speeding, or, you know, there's something wrong in the way he's driving. You always have somebody who is authorized to step into the scene, who is given the permission to break certain rules and catch up with that person and, you know, haul him up or say that, you know, you're not following the rules, right? We call them traffic police or cops who come in. They actually start disrupting the system, right? That's what they do. They're allowed to come and speed. They're allowed to go probably shift from, you know, you don't expect a policeman who's chasing a criminal to stick to one particular lane. They're allowed to break all of these rules and apprehend that person. And what is the idea behind it? To ensure that order is restored. So when we look at that, I mean, what a traffic police is to chaos in a situation like that is what a kshatriya is meant to be when there is adharma in society. And Arjuna is supposed to be one of the kshatriyas, one important great warrior who has this task in front of him. But he is saying, how can I step into this traffic? How can I, you know, if I start breaking the traffic rules, what will happen to all the others? They will also not follow it. This argument is completely false, because not everybody can do that, but some people are authorized to do that. The police are authorized to do that. That's why we call them the law enforcement agencies. Their duty is to enforce law. Arjuna's duty right now is to enforce law, and he is authorized to do that. But he's saying, how can I, who see clearly, come and do this thing, and how can I disrupt? And because of me disrupting, all of these things will happen, right? The basic mistake is Arjuna is seeing himself as the disruptor and not as the one who has to set right things, the one who is supposed to enforce the law. And this is the lack of clarity that is leading to the confusion, which we refer to as Arjuna's Vishada. And so he says, we'll go to the next verse where he again summarizes whatever he's trying to argue through these verses.
Utsannakuladharmanam manushyanam janardana narake niyatam vaso bhavati tyanushushruma.
We have heard, O Janardana, that inevitable is the dwelling for an unknown period in hell for those men in whose families the religious practices have been destroyed. So after giving all his explanations, Arjuna says, I have heard from my teachers, Utsanna kuladharmanam manushyanam, those men that destroyed the family traditions and dharmas. Some translated this particular line, Utsanna kuladharmanam Manushyanam. Some translate it as those who destroy the family traditions and dharmas. It is also said as those who are a product of families where the traditions are destroyed. But both ways, what happens to them? Narake niyatam vaso bhavati iti. That they will definitely go to hell. So Arjuna is saying, see, I have learnt all of these lessons from my teachers in the Gurukula. I have been a very attentive student in my moral science class. I have heard that those that cause the destruction of dharma will go to hell. But the only mistake is, as we saw in the previous work, he is thinking that by fighting, he will be a disruptor, whereas Arjuna's role is that of a protector, right? That is where the confusion comes. But he says that, I have heard from my teachers that this is what will happen to somebody who disrupts. But then, as I said, it is not fair on our part to look at Arjuna and say that, hey, Arjuna, you're confused. We are able to say that because we know what is Krishna going to say after this. You know, the problem of knowing more than we should know when we're going through a text is that our way of looking at Arjuna today is a little biased because we know what are Krishna's arguments going to be. But nevertheless, looking at it from Arjuna's point of view right now, his thoughts are very, very noble, right? He is noble and he is looking at all of the options which are in front of him. And, you know, if Duryodhana and his brothers, or even if Duryodhana's father, Dhritarashtra, had 1% of the nobility that Arjuna has, they wouldn't be in the Kurukshetra battle fighting. And imagine all of these arguments which Arjuna is giving, which are so very beautiful. I mean, they are actually, a capsule of what Dharma Shastra says, how dharma is protected in a society. You're very, very beautiful. And he says, what will be the consequence of those who try and disrupt dharma in this manner in the society? He's giving it so beautifully well explained. And even as Arjuna is explaining all of this, Sanjaya is sitting there and relaying it to Dhritarashtra. Even after listening to it, Dhritarashtra does not feel that, oh my God, what have I done? What have I started off in the form of this war? Let me call my sons and stop this battle. Right? He doesn't see this. So that shows the nobility of Arjuna and of course the Pandava brothers. Right? So though we are saying that Arjuna is confused, though we are saying that Arjuna is supposed to think of himself as a law enforcement agent, but he's looking at himself as a criminal, all of these confusions are there. We cannot take them away, but we cannot take away from the fact that Arjuna is very, very noble. Arjuna is very, very good at heart. That is why he is able to see all of these things. We'll go to verse number 45 and we'll see what Arjuna has to say there.
Aho bata mahat papam kartum vyavasita vayam yadrajya sukhalobhena hantum svajana mudyata.
Alas, we are involved in a great sin, in that we are prepared to kill our own kinsmen through greed for pleasure of kingdom. So with all these thoughts, Arjuna is literally disgusted with himself. He's asking, how did we ever end up here? Swajanam hantum udyataha, prepared to kill our own. Rajya sukha lobhena, out of greed for the pleasures that come with the kingdom. Just a few verses ago, of course for us it was last week, Arjuna said that the Kauravas' sight is clouded by greed, but we are not greedy, our sight is not clouded by greed, so we should be acting differently. But now he says that inspired by the greed for kingdom, Rajya Sukha Lobhena, we have come to fight, and how disgusting of us. He says, Aho bata mahat papam kartum. Alas, what a great sin we are about to perform. So when what is rightfully yours, right? When the whole battle happens because this is a kingdom which is supposed to belong to Yudhishthira, supposed to be ruled by Yudhishthira, and very, very unfairly they're being treated. So when what is rightfully belongs to you, when what is rightfully yours, if that is not given to you and you fight for it, I don't think it can be referred to as greed, though Arjuna is saying that. Now, sometimes when we get very, very angry, when someone repeatedly wrongs us, or when someone is being wronged and we get very angry, we often refer to that anger as righteous anger, right? And when we stand up for what is right, even if we will benefit out of it, it is not greed, right? Yes, when I'm being wronged and I'm standing up and I'm fighting for it, I will benefit at the end of it, but that does not mean that I am fighting for the benefit. And because I'm getting benefit, it does not make my anger propelled by greed, right? But nevertheless, Arjuna is very, very depressed, right? Arjuna is in a state where he's not clearly seeing. That is what it is. So he's saying that, you know, that is one more reason why we say Arjuna is confused, and Krishna's discourse will address this particular problem, because this clarity that he is lacking, that he knows that at the end of it he's going to win the battle, and winning the battle means winning the kingdom, that does not mean that what he is doing is out of greed. And even when you're doing the right thing, even when you're standing up for the right cause, to be propelled by any form of emotion, you know, the Kauravas are wrong because, as rightly Arjuna described, their vision is blurred by their greed even that is wrong. And as we said here, Arjuna is about to perform the right thing, but his vision is also blurred by attachment or his idea that these are all my people. At the same time, Arjuna should not participate in the war driven by the feeling of vengeance or anger too. Right? That is one more thing which Krishna is going to clarify through the Bhagavad Gita, because I'm not going to go through that. We have enough time to go through that as we enter the other chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. But this is again one more important thing that Krishna will clarify to Arjuna, that he does not want him to participate in the war driven by vengeance. He is prepared for the battle that way. He has stepped to the battle that way. Yes, there is a sense of dharma too. You know, from all that what Arjuna has spoken, Arjuna does have a very, very strong sense of propriety and what is right and wrong. But mixed with that is also this anger, also this vengeance. And the entire discourse which is going to follow, Krishna is going to filter out those emotions propelled by which one should not do any action, even if it were a right action, right? That we will come to that. But for now, let us continue. Arjuna is cursing himself and wondering, why did all this occur? Why did we not think of all this even before we came to the battlefield? That's what he's wondering. Alas, how did we even think of winning the battle this way and, you know, enjoying the kingdom at the end of it? We'll go to the 46th verse, the penultimate verse of the first chapter.
Yadi mama pratikaram ashastram shastra parnayaha dhartarashtrarane hanyuhu tanme kshematarambhavet bhavet.
In this battle, the sons of Dhritarashtra, armed with weapons, kill me, who am non-resistant and unarmed. That will be more beneficial to me. So Arjuna says, of all the options available right now, the best is to be killed. That's what he's saying. And, you know, how much many of us will be able to relate to that. And this is probably one of the weaknesses of the human mind. When there are options in front of us which are not likable to us or not suitable to us, we always think of the option of running away from there, getting killed or being killed or killing herself. That's probably one of the dangers of the human mind. It always looks at that as an option, and Swami would reiterate over and over again. And of course here Arjuna is not talking about suicide, he's talking about allowing himself to be killed. But that option of running away from a situation through death is one of the most wrong attitudes to have. That's what Swami would say. But he says, but of all the options that are available, he says, I would rather wish to be killed and not killed by fighting. It's not like I will fight till my last moment and I'll get killed. Because Arjuna is saying, he said in the previous verse that even trying to kill these people is a sin. Forget killing them. So he is saying, I am not even going to try. I am not even going to participate. And for having come to fight, he has decided, it is right that I do not resist being killed also. That's why he says, Yadi mam apratikaram, even if I do not resist, ashastram, even if I am unarmed and I am killed by the people who are Dhritarashtra's sons who are coming armed to kill me, he says even that is better. Which means it is wrong, you know, to kill a person who is not armed with weapons is actually a dharma. Arjuna is saying that I know it is adharma to for a warrior to attack a person who is unarmed or who is not willing to fight. But even though that is adharma, that seems to be a lesser evil than the evil that I've come here to perform. Which he says that if I participate in the war and if I'm going to kill all of these warriors, all the explanation which he gave about what is going to happen to dharma in society and what is the confusion which is going to, it is going to cause even in the Pitruloka, right? Not only here, but even in the land of the mains. That's what he says. So he says that I know that to kill a person who is unarmed is wrong, but even that adharmic act seems to be a lesser evil compared to what I've come here to do. So he's saying that I feel that is the best option right now. I will just stand here. Probably the war is going to begin. The conscience have already been blown. So the war is going to begin at any moment now. Let them come and finish me off. So with this, actually Arjuna finishes all his arguments. And the last verse of the first chapter, the 47th verse, is Sanjaya summarizing this entire scene to Dhritarashtra. We'll listen to that. I'll give you the meaning of that. And we'll conclude with that.
Sanjaya uvacha eva muktvarjuna sankhe rathopastha upavishat visrujya sasharam chapam shokasam vigna manasaha.
Sanjaya said, having thus spoken in the midst of the battlefield, Arjuna, casting away his bow and arrow, sat down on the seat of the chariot with his mind overwhelmed with sorrow. So having made all of these arguments that we've been going through for the past couple of weeks, finally Arjuna crashes to his seat on the chariot. Visrujya sasharam chapam, keeping aside his bow and arrow, shoka samvigna manasaha, with a mind heavy and overwhelmed with sorrow. And Swami would say that when this was told to Dhritarashtra, Dhritarashtra was so happy. Of course, this is all a flashback for him, but nevertheless, he must have been so happy that, my God, if Arjuna is going to withdraw from the battlefield, then there is no way that the Pandavas are going to win. But this is the summary which Sanjaya gives Dhritarashtra. And as we have said many times before, Sanjaya can not only see the scene, but he can also sense the emotion, and he can see how genuine the goodness and the broad-mindedness of Arjuna is, because he is sincerely feeling it that way. And this is probably the final sign that Arjuna is giving. He, till now, he has not let go of the Gandiva, but at this point he actually lets go of the Gandiva and the arrows, and he also crashes down to his seat, which is a sign that he does not wish to fight. And he means it. I mean, this is not up for negotiation. That's what he means. So he crashes, right? So the idea which the entire first chapter gives, I'll probably conclude with this thought, is that, as I said, Arjuna is not uninitiated in the concept of dharma. He's not a novice. He was pretty well versed. And the reason it is important to remember this, remember that Arjuna was coming from a level of enormous goodness and righteousness, is when later in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna starts talking about the Karma Yoga, and we all know Karma Yoga is nothing but doing one's actions, giving up the results. A lot of people ask this question of, so can I do bad actions and wrong actions with the feeling that I don't want the results of the actions? I'm just doing it like Karma Yoga. Will that work? Well, the answer to that is, the Karma Yoga as a concept was being given to Arjuna, and this is the nature of Arjuna. The first chapter was how well trained Arjuna was in the concept of dharma, and he was also a follower of dharma. We will not forget that. And at this stage, actually, the Karma Yoga is being offered to Arjuna. So if some people ask, can I do bad karmas and then practice it as Karma Yoga? Definitely not. The reason why probably Krishna does not mention it is because Arjuna does not need that mentioning. And the reason why we have to go through the first chapter, even though it is not yet the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita means the song of Bhagwan. God has not yet started speaking, but still the first chapter is important because this is the prerequisite to be able to dwell into and understand the words of the Lord. This is the basic goodness which is important. When we say karma yoga is important, when we say that one has to lead a life of a karma yogi, this basic right actions is the prerequisite. We cannot ask that can I be a dharmic person and then follow karma yoga, right? If that was the case, karma yoga would have been taught to Dhritarashtra or Duryodhana, right? It was not taught to them, it was taught to Arjuna, because Arjuna not only had vishada or despondency, but it was backed by goodness. That is why it was Arjuna Vishada which led to yoga. And that is something that we should probably always keep in mind. So with that concludes the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. I will probably end with the epilogue, which says that this is the conclusion of the first chapter. I'll give you the meaning of that. And with that, we'll conclude today's show.
इति श्रीमद्भगवद्गीतासु उपनिषत्सु ब्रह्मविद्यायां योगशास्त्रे श्रीकृष्णार्जुनसंवादे अर्जुनविषादयोगो नाम प्रथमोऽध्यायः.
Thus ends the first chapter called Arjuna Vishada Yoga, the chapter of Arjuna's sorrow in the Bhagavad Gita, which is in the form of a dialogue between Shri Krishna and Arjuna, which is the essence of the Upanishads, whose subject matter is both the knowledge of Brahma and yoga. So with that, we'll conclude, dear listeners, this week's episode and the first chapter. The next time when I meet you, we'll begin the all-important second chapter, because that is the chapter where Lord Krishna begins speaking, and one of the most important chapters in many ways, as we will see, because he speaks about Sankhya Yoga, which is nothing but Jnana Yoga itself. Most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. Thank you all for joining me. We'll meet again 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of the Gita series, and we'll resume this pilgrimage, which is a triune pilgrimage. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Vishu and Sai Prakash for the Vahini Satsang. I'll meet you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. Happy listening.